everybody, and welcome to episode 36 of the Alexi Sale podcast. Now, we've taken a bit of a swerve into the subject of Palestine with Adam Bloomberg and then Bassem Youssef. Well, Bassem Youssef was more, I suppose, the Middle East, wasn't he, really? But, you know, touched on
and Youssef, Imran Youssef.
Imran Youssef as well, yeah. Mm. So we got that shit sorted out. It's all fixed. if you're wondering, Israel has decided to become one state, pluralistic.
They kicked BB out.
Yeah.
They exiled said, into London. He's staying in a Holiday Inn in Piccadilly now.
They said, we're sorry. We realise it was all a terrible mistake. It's apartheid and racism and oppression. And we're going to get fixed that shit. Everything will be fine by Monday. So that's
we did
largely
it.
Thanks to us.
Yeah.
So something we should be proud of. Now, actually, in a way, considering the... it's just me and Talal this week. And just keeping going with the Arabian theme, the reason that we're doing this now and maybe may have a little bit of a hiatus is because Talal is off on tour, isn't that right?
Oh, yes. No, this show isn't about me, but we won't be able to record an episode over April because, I'll be touring with a little theatre production of Tales of 1001 Nights, the Shahrazad.
Yeah.
Tales of Arabian Nights. And I thought I'd use this opportunity to ask you about your experiences in the theatre because it's very difficult. Right. I haven't done theatre since I was a kid, basically. Not proper theatre. And I've never had to learn this many lines before.
All right.
Basically, the whole second act of the play is basically me talking practically the whole time. Because I'm playing Sinbad in the second half and I'm telling all seven voyages. I'm telling the story of all seven of his voyages.
Right.
And it's a lot of fucking text.
Yeah,
I'm quite scared and anxious about that, about learning all of it. So I wanted to see if we could, if I could kneel down before the great wise sage, Alexi Sale, whose experience is broad and multi...
Not yet.
And ask your advice or if you have any fun stories and and anecdotes from your time in the theater, darling.
Yes. Well, first of all,
it's funny rehearsing with this crew. Mm-hmm. We do it literally, you end up becoming a lovey. It just happens naturally. I don't understand.
Yeah.
We all call each other darling and it was very touchy feely. And
well, I think funnily enough, I was presenting an award at the BBC Audio Awards last Sunday and I just came away with a great love for the acting profession, really, because I thought, these people are trying to make the world a better place, particularly in that sort of end of like theatre, and it's not, I mean, there is egotism, but they're not, it's not about stardom or anything, that they are dedicated to their craft and dedicated to, being mankind's kind of storytellers. And I felt tremendous effect. If it had been if it would have been an award ceremony for people from News and Current Affairs, you just think, what a bunch of fucking bastards they would have been. I mean, just fucking terrible people. Or if it was politics, some political fucking awards, you'd just be fucking... People there would have been so appalling, awful. I mean, even people on the left are sometimes.
It's a craft of fueled by love, isn't it? The theater.
Yeah, exactly.
People do it because they love it and they love spending time with their peers and portraying these characters. And
it's, I always think of that line, in the first Bourne film where Clive Owen is the professor, Bourne's just shot him. And he says, do you get the headaches? He says, He says, look what they make us give. But I always think that about all actors, really. We live our lives through actors. And the shit we make them, we ask of them to expose themselves to have, sex with in a freezing room with 40 people watching to pretend to create these worlds that we absorb, unthinkingly,
channeling their grief and loss in order to create sadness as a performance. You
and then
have to tap into.
Yeah, and they're often sort of made, you know, made fun of their kind of ridiculous aspects. But you know, I think it is a noble, it's a noble trade, really. And
someone's got to do it.
Yeah, well, yeah, we live our lives through these people, really.
In your career, was there a time when you started taking acting more seriously than before? Because
that's one of the things I regret, really. And I didn't really take that on board. I didn't concentrate enough on my own acting career. I think that I could be a good actor when I was cast in the right role. I could be fucking terrible in the wrong role. And I did like movies and stuff just because I thought either for, you know, just to be in a movie or just because I wanted, you know, I thought, well, it'd be nice to be in Australia for 3 months or something. Hmm. Not really thinking about the work. I mean, as from my original cohort, I mean, one of the people that I admire is Adrian Edmondson, really, because Adrian, you know, decided he wanted to be serious about acting. And he spent a couple of years in Holby City, you know, he spent a couple of years in a soap, and then he's learned his craft. He wasn't great at first, but he learned his craft, and now he's a very good actor now. But it's only, he just learned how to do it, and he's done plays, and he's done, you know, he's been all over the place doing shit. Whereas I'd be doing some terrible bloody film in thousands of miles away, or I'd just be snottily kind of turning down roles, you know, and thinking I had nothing to learn. And so I really admire Adrian in that way, that he really dedicated himself to the craft in a way that I haven't. I mean, it's not necessarily too late for me, but yeah, you know, I'm very admiring of his dedication to the craft.
Really. That's very nice to hear you say. Interesting you say that about how if you're in the right role, you can be a great actor. And I suppose that is a big part of it. If a role just really suits you, you just fit into it perfectly. But then the real challenge is changing yourself, molding yourself into something.
Well, there's two things, really. There's, first of all, not doing the really, really stupid roles, not being in fucking absolute shite like Carry On Columbus and stuff.
20 grand for a car, Z.
Yeah, Lovejoy.
Lovejoy.
20 grand, Lovejoy. Yeah, Lovejoy. Yeah, all that. So not doing that. So not sort of, you know, not learning the wrong lessons. So doing the right, doing the right roles, learning the right, you know, and being a bit humble, doing plays and stuff like that where you learn stuff.
Yeah.
But I suppose being better in bad roles. When I had a bad role, I think I didn't really bring much to the, you know, I just, there weren't many shitty roles where I made them better, really, which is what good actors can do, really, but I just made them worse. Yeah, but occasionally I could be, you know, occasionally I could be good. I mean, you can list these are all long in the past, but there's a comic strip movie called Supergrass. I'm really good in that. The Strike, the Supergrass that won the Golden Rose of Montreux. I'm really good in that. Indiana Jones, whatever. I mean, it's, you know, that's okay. There was a sort of a film on, Film 2, BBC film, called Night Voice, in which I play a late night radio DJ. I'm good in that. And that's about it, really. And everything else, the many, many, many movies I've made,
Is it a silly question to ask? What's your proudest moment in terms of acting?
I'm Supergrass. I'm really funny.
Yeah,
and that that's where I took the role, really, and I really brought something to the party.
Fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, long time ago. But interestingly enough, I have also been in two productions of The Arabian Nights.
Yes.
One was that, because you did the ADR for it, didn't you? For the
in 2000, the year 2000, that was.
Yeah. The did I tell the story? Because I play in that. I play the Sultan's favorite storyteller, who's a dwarf or a midget. And they made a rubber. They made little Alexei. They made a little. So I'm not in most of, because me, Alexei, full-sized, me playing a dwarf, you know, I sat in like a gigantic chair, and that was a little. And then he chokes in the house of some Jewish people, and then they have to try and get rid of the body. But that's a rubber version of me that they made.
Yes. Oh, wow. Because we're telling that story in our play. We're calling it the Little Hunchback. The Little Hunchback.
Yeah.
That's Backpack, is it?
That's the one I was in.
I'm the one who he first dies in my house. I play the tailor. The
Jewish tailor, yeah.
And he chokes on a fishbone, and then we dispose of the body and frame someone else for it, and then he frames someone else, and they frame someone else, and then it's like a big farcical. So is that you? And they're just carrying around a little dummy, a little rubber you.
But when I showed my mother a photo of me and little Alexi, little rubber Alexi, and she mistook rubber Alexi for me. She said, "Is that you?" I said, "No, fuck off. That's a rubber dummy." And then she said, No, it isn't, and hit me. Typical of my mother. Yeah, she mistook me. She mistook her own son for a rubber dummy of himself. And wouldn't admit that she was wrong. No, that's you. No, it's like fucking 3 foot tall, apart from anything else. Shut up. That was Molly. Was the first production, directed by Steve Barron, of course. He did, Vienna, did the one of the world's first pop videos.
Vienna.
Ultravox. Yeah, he directed that.
Oh, right. That was a Hallmark movie.
Hallmark movie, yeah.
Yeah. So what was the other one you did?
And the other one I did was an avant-garde radio production starring, amongst others, Indira Varma. You know Indira Varma, who's in Game of Thrones, plays becomes queen of the sand snakes or some shit like that. And it was really, it was highly avant-garde production. It recorded on location. I remember recording in, I think, a Cricklewood cemetery or some cemetery somewhere.
I thought you said it was on the radio.
It was on the radio, yeah. It was Radio 4.
So where did you film it?
Well, we didn't. It was just radio. We just recorded it.
You recorded it outdoors?
Yeah. You know, sometimes they do. Oh,
just to get the ambience.
Yeah, get the atmosphere. Right. It makes no fucking difference whatsoever.
Oh, wow. Indira Varma. Oh, so was this recent then?
No, it was it was Game of Thrones, because I said to her, because I knew her character's plot line. I said, "Oh, you know, you've just been murdered by Queen Cersei." And she said, "Oh, I don't watch that shit." I said, "Well, she made me feel foolish."
So was that, who did you play in that one?
I have no idea.
Oh.
Okay. I can't remember. I think I played loads of parts in that. It was very avant-garde and really wasn't recommissioned.
Okay, I see.
So that is those are my memories of Arabian Nights. Now, more theatre. Of course, I've only ever done one play, which was a production of The Tempest in 1988 at
the Old Vic,
at the Old Vic, directed by Jonathan Miller. Yeah. And that production was marred by, since you're worried about learning your lines, was marred on the first night by Max von Sydow, who played Prospero, actually dried for about 5 minutes, and it was nightmarish.
moment. So what did that look like? What do you mean he dried?
He just couldn't remember his lines. Rudy Davis, who was his, played Miranda, was trying to prompt him and stuff. And I wasn't there, and I was backstage, so I didn't know. But it fucking terrified. And it actually meant that when me and the other guy playing, the other drunken servant, came on, we got a standing ovation because people were so relieved that, we obviously knew our lines and we kind of, we were funny.
So you played a drunken servant. Was that
Trinket?
Doesn't sound like the biggest part.
No, I thought I would ease my way into it, really, this would be, because everybody says, oh, you were in The Tempest. Did you play Caliban? The monster. I'm like, no, fuck off. So anyway, that was that. And recently, and I don't know if I shouldn't be, I was couple of years ago, I went to see Lenny Henry down Chichester in press on the press night of Educating Rita. And he dried on stage. He just suddenly couldn't remember where he was. And he dealt with it very well, I think, because he said, because it just sends the audience into an absolute panic.
Yes.
And he just said, oh, I can't remember where I am. He said, I'm going to go off and start this scene again. And he did. And then it was fine, you know.
That's and a I think big that was actually a very way to. Probably quite think, smart, yeah.
I think that acknowledging it is the best way to deal with it, really. I know it kind of breaks the fourth wall and stuff, but certainly you know, that, and it just, they put everybody at ease and it was fine, really, and, you know. It wasn't a brilliant production in a way, but
God, that is my biggest fear, really, because I do have.
Yeah, like, well, that's what obviously
paragraph
why I
after paragraph after paragraph, yeah. after paragraph after paragraph, the whole second half is me just telling entire stories with like the other cast running around me and like being little parts in the story and jumping in and out of the.
Yeah, well, if you do get, like, yeah, I just think if you do get, like, I mean, you've got to. Presumably you've got somebody to prompt you if...
Yes, I suppose. But also if I can... As long as I remember the story, I'll know where it's going and then I can hopefully find my feet again if that happens.
But yeah.
But if I don't, this is a very lateral move for me. I don't know why I'm doing this job. Mainly because I need the money, actually. Because it's a paying job and I didn't want to turn it down.
Yeah.
But it's not like me. You know, I haven't done theatre, like I said, since I was a kid. And it's... It's quite intimidating, but yeah, tour.
Yeah,
so what about touring?
Touring. I mean, I've kind of been lucky touring because I've never had to do one of those tours where, you know, you have to stay with some theatrical landladies and shit like that. Because it's always just been me, really. You know, I've been offered tours over the years. I was offered quite recently a tour of My Fair Lady. And I just thought, I'm too old for this shit, really. Uh-huh. You know, I can't imagine spending a week in, you know, Norwich, you know, beautiful as it is, really. But
You know, you've toured with your stand-up, though, back in the day.
But yeah, toured with the stand-up. Yeah, but that's sort of different.
Were those heavy schedule ones? Were those every night, one after the other?
Yeah, I used to. Yeah, I did a bit of that, yeah. Not like Stuart or something. But, I mean, yeah, that's kind of okay, though. You've got nice hotels and... You know, I've talked a lot, I think, about, I mean, it was much more difficult in the 80s touring because all the hotels were awful and the staff were horrible and you couldn't, you know, there was no rooms, you know, you couldn't, you know, I said before about Alan Linda was at the time was a vegetarian, the only after the show, the only kind of vegetarian meal she could get was to buy a kebab and then throw the meat away.
Oh, God.
And it was just, you know, if you were in Stoke or somewhere. But, I mean, kind of shit's different now, you know. I mean, you know, everybody's much nicer, really, I think. You don't get those awful hotels anymore. And so, you know, I think all that's a lot easier, really.
Our director is this proper lovey actor, called Elliot, lovely guy, and he was telling every time we have a bit of downtime, he tells us a story from his colourful past of acting.
All right.
And he was telling us about this tour, this theatre tour he did, and he was touring with an old actor who was in Yes, Prime Minister, actually, this old guy, I can't remember his name, but he was touring with him, and they were staying in B&Bs, and this old actor said to him, he's like, you know, you should always check the guest book when you leave. I always sign the guest book because you look at who else has stayed and underneath their message, they'll write the letters LDO. And then you'll know that you can have a good time. And have you heard this LDO thing?
No, no.
He goes, I said, what does LDO mean? And he said, he goes, landlady's daughter obliges. You know you're in for a treat if it says LDO in the guest book. It's like a secret code actors would put in the guest books. Back in like the 40s and in the 40s and 50s.
Well, I don't know what, you know. Oblige is what? She give you a meat ration?
In a way, I suppose. Oh, God.
Yeah.
It must have been fun. Like the 30s, 40s.
Kind of.
Touring and just, not because of the landlady's daughter, but just the the camaraderie and the
yes,
and getting pissed out of your head and
yeah,
such a different time as well.
Yeah, different, you know, different. Yes, as Ollie Double, who we interviewed, has written a book about.
I really liked him.
Which I'm using because I'm writing a novel about set in the sort of 30s, partly set in the world of light entertainment. And he's got a very kind of quite an academic book about, you know, the circuit and the landladies. And now you would, you know, have your luggage sent on, you know, and there'd be special.
Oh, wow. Kind of,
you know, it was a kind of complex business, but, you know, the railways would know that touring companies, you know, you'd have your props sent on to the theatre and, you know, so on and so forth, you know, to, you know, and it was a massive kind of industry, really, of boarding houses and,
before trains.
And, Yeah.
See, we've just got a van and a car and we're just going to go around in that. And it's just, boom.
Yeah. It's a lot. It's not what it was, but there's elements of it I always think which I quite like. That I always used to think that, you know, when I was playing, like, you know, Oxford Playhouse or, you know, Manchester Apollo or the Palladium, or, you know, I was doing stand up. I think, well, there's an, you know, I mean, obviously the references are, yeah, my references to Bertolt Brecht or Marxism or, you know, a kind of profound hatred of the royal family. The material's different, but in a sense, I am just a 10. You know, I'm a conventional. There's a lot of me that is very much in the mold of the stand-up comedian. You know, that kind of, you know, that kind of character, that kind of performance style that came into being, I guess, in the late, with the musicals in the late mid 19th century. And you know,
did you ever play the old Rep Theatre in Birmingham?
The Rep, yeah.
The old Rep.
I don't know. I played it's an old one. I think, yeah.
There's a new one and an old one, yeah. It's one of the
I
oldest
the
theaters.
Old one, yeah.
I played that with Basim.
Yeah.
And it's like 110 years old, that theater. And I was standing there before the show and just imagining all the vaudevillians in there.
Yeah.
Telling stupid double entendres and doing their silly things. There is quite a vaudevillian element to your classic, your old character, your Alexei character.
Yeah. So
his outfit and his voice and energy.
Yeah. Yeah. And even the new, you know, even the new, you know, Alexei Mark II, there's elements.
We did some live shows at the Museum of Comedy.
Yeah.
And on the last one, someone asked you to show your dancing skills.
That was so good.
You were doing like the samba. You were showing everyone a guide to the samba and then the salsa and the cha-cha. And you were really moving, man.
Yeah, yeah. I'd forgotten that. You know, there was one of the great English footballers was called Jimmy Greaves, played for Spurs, was in this squad for the 1966 World Cup, but wasn't used in the final.
Jimmy Greaves.
But he... somebody asked him about, you know, matches, and he said, I can't remember any of them. He said, I was so moment.
Yes.
That I can't remember. I've got, you know, no memory of any match I ever played in. And I'm a bit like that with stand-up, really. It's a bit like you go through you know, I can remember going on stage and then I can remember coming off stage, and everything in between is kind of
it just belongs to that moment, doesn't it?
Yeah
it is strange. Magical. But in those shows I had the pleasure of just sitting there mostly and getting to observe. But it was those are really nice shows, and thank you for inviting me along.
You were doing
work in progresses, but for Sandwich Bar, but you invited me along for some reason, but I think it worked.
It was all right. Yeah, it was fine. Yeah, it gave me a clear idea of, you know, I think what I need to do in the future with those.
Good. Live I'm shows. Excited to see what happens with that.
Yeah,
but speaking of that and your dancing and vaudevillians, makes me think how to go back to the craft.
In the day.
Even if you were a comedian, a vaudevillian or whatever, you had to be able to tap dance at the top level. You had to be able to sing at the top level and tell jokes and do slapstick or clowning. People were just very multifaceted as a rule. Like, if you couldn't do all of them well, then you were worthless, essentially. And that's kind of gone now. A stand-up now is just a stand-up. And
yeah. I mean, it's not necessarily. I think there probably were acts that were just, you know, just well, talk. Sure. And do, but, I mean, yeah, your average comedian would be, you know, would be able to, you know, like Morecambe and Wise and stuff, you know, they could dance, yes. they could sing, they could, you know, they could. They didn't really try, but they could have been serious actors if they'd wanted.
Mm.
And yeah, the sort of the modern comedian that just comes on and jabbers, really, I think something has been slightly lost in that, really.
The showbiz element.
The showbiz kind of, element, yeah.
Stagecraft.
Yeah. I think, you know, but I'm reluctant to sound like some whiny old Jim Davidson fuck really saying, you know, it's not, you know, the business has changed. So, I always felt certainly that you should, you know, you should sing, you should dance, you know, to the extent of how you were able, really. And I think, you know, my stand-up comedy progeny, Stuart Lee, who is, I mean, almost, you know, is also... One of the things I liked about as Stuart has developed really is he's become more physical. I think he's not, you know, he's never going to be singing and dancing, I don't think, but he has, there's a greater physicality in his act really, which, you know, it's the same kind of grow and change and stuff.
I saw him not too long ago and his energy is insane. He had a broken leg as well, but he had, really? He had so much energy up there and he was walking around on this cast.
Fucking hell. And he does it all, I mean, in a way that I never. Every night he's fucking performing somewhere. I mean, he's done more gigs in a year than I've done in my entire career, really. Just think how good I'd be if I could be asked doing it.
I know, that's how I feel.
I'm fucking, man. I'm so brilliant. We're not going to do like about 8 gigs a year.
Yeah.
Think how extraordinary I would have been if I could be asked getting out there. It's a tragedy that I don't. I can't be fucked, really. And I'm 70. So fuck it. I might have got worse fuck anyway. I might,
yeah, you might have got too big for your boots.
Yeah. Should we do some? How is our community? How is our podcast community?
Hello, community. Like how are you all? Please send us messages on alexislpodcast@gmail.com. If you subscribe to our Patreon, patreon.com/alexislpodcast, you can send us messages there.
Feel like we've been neglecting them a bit, really.
Yeah, we have. So let's have a little look through. I've actually had a few messages asking if you're going to run against Starmer, seeing as you live in his constituency.
Yeah, well, I did. I went on some podcast or other. No, I don't think. Well, you know, I've sort of been. I think more and more, I've been thinking about. I mean, that's a sort of thing I've been thinking a lot. Really, is that I think comedians should just do comedy and not. Do other shit, really. Yes. I have been from time to time an activist, and I grow less comfortable with it, really. And I think that it's more difficult. But if obviously I have, you know, I'm very in a way unhappy about, you know, the way politics and is going in this country. But I think that what you should do as an artist is put it into your art, not either become.
But some people do. Politics, as a comedy thing, like Binhead or whatever, you know, those they do it as a performance art.
Well, that's fine. I mean, that's right.
And you know,
but I just think, you know, I should just do stuff about the current. I'm sort of less happy about speaking in meetings and stuff like that. But
a similar minded person ran against Starmer in your constituency, I'm sure that they could count on your support.
I would happily campaign for them. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. There we go. Lovely. Fucking... Okay. That's your answer for all those people who messaged
me.
I
hate that man.
Oh mate. Oh my God. Some of these. So we get messages of people who have like just discovered the show or discovered it recently, and they are commenting on episodes we did yonks ago, you know? And it's so lovely. I'm not complaining.
Yeah.
But it's like, it feels weird reading it out now, but Still, someone commented on the episode we did at the Cartoon Museum. It's only available on the Patreon.
Yeah.
And they were very happy that we mentioned that Warburton's is Tory, treacherous Tory yes. toast.
Yeah, boycott divestments and sanctions Warburton's.
Yes.
And JCB, probably, if you're buying a digger, backhoe digger, then...
Oh, really?
Well, it's a bit like, you know, I talked about the... how in the 70s, one of the reasons that left-wing people looked so pasty and ill was because you couldn't get an anti-fascist orange, you know?
Yes.
They were either from Israel, you know, Jaffa, or from Morocco, which was a cruel and repressive kingdom, or South Africa. And so... left wingers were, you know, highly deficient in
scurvy all over the shop.
Yeah, that's why they look so ill on those demos. And similarly, I think it's hard, if you're in the construction business, it's hard to get an anti-fascist because JCB is, you know, the Bamford family are raving Tories, and then Caterpillar, I know, is used in Israeli house demolitions
for demolishing Palestinian homes.
Demolishing Palestinian homes, and Volvo, I think, also complicit.
No,
So I don't know if you're going to buy if you're looking to buy construction equipment. I don't know where you would turn. Maybe
on
one
the
of
other
Japanese...
hand, though, during the earthquake, the horrible, terrible earthquakes in Turkey and Syria,
mm-hmm.
I think they were Caterpillar diggers being used to
I would have said, if I'd been, I said, no, I don't want to be rescued by a fuck off with your Caterpillar.
Get out of it.
Equipment.
No, leave me. Go get a spade.
Yeah.
You lazy Zionist. Digger. Get it out of here.
I think the Koreans make construction equipment, don't they? Hyundai.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Get that.
That'd be all right. I'd have one of them.
Oh, get the Kim Jong pneumatic drill.
Yeah, they don't know.
I'll be waiting here. I'm not going anywhere. I'll wait right here.
Yeah.
Someone says, hi, Alexi and Talal. Just thought I'd write in whilst I'm throwing a vegetable lasagna in the bin and having a pie instead.
Nice. Yeah, yeah. I'm going to do that as a bit, really. I'm going to do that. I think on the next year's sandwich bar, which should be next year, I'm going to... that bit which
I don't know
improvised.
If we did that on the podcast or just in the live show.
And we did it somewhere just about fucking... Well, it is. They're not going to blow it, am I? Really, it's just about Radio 6 Music. How they email in, they're always making a vegetable lasagna.
So, yeah.
No, hi, Craig. You're just making a vegetable lasagna for me and my partner Zambang. And later on, we're going to see the fraudulent insurance claims at the old.
This is. I've actually had a couple of messages about this. So when we had Imran Yusuf on, thank you, Imran, for a lovely episode, lovely guy, and happy Ramadan to you.
Ramadan Mubarak.
Ramadan Mubarak.
To all our listeners.
Yes, so they're saying about, because you talked on that episode about how he was asking you when you're going to come back, do stand-up, when you're going to do more stand-up, and then your musing at that current moment was... All you have to talk about is how all your friends are dying and you can't really write good stand-up about.
Yeah.
And this person, Neil, said, you should do it. Keep doing what you're doing. You should go out there. Looking forward to Alexi's 2024 tour of All My Peers Are Dead. And I had a really nice email, so I'm just going to switch back to the email, because there was a really nice one, a show about death from Alan. He's been listening to the podcast, heard Alexi made a passing comment about how would you write material about approaching death. Oh, so you were also worried about your own approaching death, not just your friends all dying. He trains people in the NHS and has a section in his training about the language used around death and dying. He's not a performer, but he does use humor in his training sessions.
That might be interesting.
The title of a piece he does is called "He Has Had a Fall of Soot," and it's taken from a phrase that he heard in the 70s about a colleague who died following years of being a heavy smoker. He has had a fall of soot.
Okay.
It refers to what periodically happens with chimneys. if you wanted to explore this idea, he would happily collaborate. So this is someone who trains NHS workers on how to talk about death and uses humor in his training.
Okay.
Thank you for your message, Alan. Let's muse on that. But I don't think it's an area free of humor. I think it can be done.
Yeah.
And it could be, you know, a really interesting, amazing tour of like
a
legendary comic who's now in his later years talking about fucking death. How iconic that would be.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
Fuck no.
Fuck no. Okay.
But maybe we. Nah, I'll just be funny. Just do funny shit. I'm not doing no miserable.
You don't like to get too personal and serious, do you?
No, I think there are
comics out there who put it all on the line. You know, they talk about everything in their life,
and that is absolutely fine. And I think I'm probably going to see Kim Noble next week at Soho Theatre, who's very much one of those people. But that's not me. I'm not somebody who ever, overshare, really.
Mm.
But, it's fine. Those who do. Well, it's not fine, but, you know, it's there.
Okay. I've had another email saying from Herman, I've never made any food whatsoever whilst listening to BBC Six Music and inform and tell the presenter about it. Although I did make scrambled eggs whilst Giles Peterson played a 14-minute instrumental of some Malawian bloke who lives in Antwerp in Belgium. Okay, that's very good. You're definitely hitting.
Obviously struck a chord, Dad.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you, Simon Wallet, for your Patreon messages. Very lovely comments about our Khan Ross Blind Boy Phil Bevan episodes. Keep fighting the fight. Well, thank you, Simon. All right, here's where is it? Okay, good day, Alexi and Talal. This is from Alan, another Alan. I've got a lot better things to do with my time than to write to you, of course, but regarding your conversation with Stuart Lee, see, about people writing us about old episodes.
How long ago was that,
More than a year ago, I think. At one point, you were fantasizing about mounting a gun on your bike. Oh, yeah, I remember this. And I remembered that there had been a cartoon in Private Eye about somebody with just such a setup. Can't remember the punchline. Oh, is this going to be... Oh, we ask him, why don't we have Mark Steele on? Do we hate him as well?
Oh, right. Well, now I've got to... No, not at all. I've got to thank Mark Steele greatly because he... There's a program on Radio 4 called A Good Read, and he went on about a month ago, and he chose my memoir, first volume of memoir, Styling Out My Homework, and all the other people on the panel were also very nice about it. And it shot up. I think it got to, like, number 25 in the Amazon... top 100, which was, and it was a book that I'd written 13 years before, and it got a lot higher than it did when I wrote it and when it was released. And it was in the top, Amazon top 100 for ages. And in fact, because of that, Kindle and Audible have chosen it as one of their offers of the month, I think, or something for April.
Yes, you can get a big discount on it, yes.
Yeah. And it was all thanks to Mark, and I never rang him and thanked him or anything, like I showed any that I'd listened to. But here I am. I heard it go out. And it really, it sold more copies, I think, last week than it did when it was released 13 years ago. Yeah. And it's available on Audible. It's a special Audible offer. We'll put it up when we get the stuff from the publishers. And, it's a special offer for 99p on Audible and Kindle and stuff like that.
I might finally fucking read that book then.
Yeah, it's very good.
So I hesitate to get too deep into, you know, your works because I don't want to get sick of you because I work with you.
Yeah.
So I do love, you know, I've before I started working with you, I was, you know, I watched a lot of stuff. I read Barcelona Plates and the other one. Mm-hmm. I love your short stories, but I've not read your memoirs yet. What's the other one called, B? The Dog Catcher?
That's the other second book? Collection of short stories.
Yes.
There's two volumes of memoirs, Stalinette, My Homework, and Thatcher Stole My Trousers.
Yes.
And then there's two volumes of short stories, Barcelona Plates and The Dogcatcher. And then there's three novels, Overtaken, Weeping Women Hotel, and Mr. Roberts.
I want to read your novel. That's what I'm going to read next. I'm going to read your novels. Yeah, which one shall I read?
Oh, Overtaken. It's brilliant.
Overtaken. All right, I'll go out and get that. And I'll get you to sign it.
Yeah.
Of course. And then I'll sell it on eBay. Okay, so Mark Steele, maybe we could get him on.
Yeah,
then.
Let's thank him in person.
And then you can go on his podcast and promote this podcast on his podcast. It's called Cross Pollination.
Fantastic.
All right. I'll reach out to Mr. Steele. You've got to go.
Soon. Is there anything vital?
We've hitting the mark. No, I think you're right. I think it's a good time. That's a lovely note to finish on. Congratulations on the new.
Yeah, no, that was a note that came out. It came out the blue, and it was really thrilling. Be up there briefly in the Amazon Top 100 really.
Hooray! Good stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, that was episode 36, I guess. Patreon.com/LSSL podcast.
I hope we're serving you reasonably well, you people that listen to this.
Yes.
I feel like we neglected you a bit recently with our, but we do. Our sense of self is very connected with your approval, really.
Yes, and we do hope you approve, dear listener. But, you know, don't forget, we never made any promises from the beginning. We never promised anything. You. So you're lucky
never
you're getting
promised
anything.
You a rose garden, no. Maybe we'll go back to doing more stuff about ammunition.
Why not? Oh, fuck. Okay, no, I will. While I'm touring in my free time, I will finish off that video of us at the rifle range.
Oh, haven't we put that up yet?
We have not put that up. Sake. I'm sorry. And then I'll put that up. No, because they had to check it. They had to check the video.
Oh, yeah.
Gave me notes on things to remove from it because they are very particular about how their gun range is viewed. Like, if we were doing anything silly. Like, there was a moment where you burnt your finger considerably on one of the big bangy guns. There was a big bangy gun that went boom,
black
boom.
Black powder revolver, yeah.
And it boom-boomed on your finger.
Yeah, it was
and they were like, you can't keep that in the video. The person you were with should have told you how to hold it properly. You remove that from the video. I'm like, that's one of the best bits in the video, you motherfucker.
Yeah. But
so we can just tell them on the podcast about it. But yeah, really annoying. But yeah, big bangy gun went boom-boom on your finger, and it was really fun. I'll put that up soon. I got to show a bit too. All right, love you, Lexi. Love you, listeners.
I love you too, Talal and Habibi. And enjoy the tour. And we better make one as soon as you come back, really. Or maybe we'll do one while you're on the road.
Yes, I will take my gear with me on the road.
Yeah.
So if any opportunities come up for guests or something, and I'll see about Mark Steele. I'll see about the other lefty comedian. What's his name again?
Mark Thomas, yeah, we were going to.
Two Marks, yeah. Maybe we'll get them together.
We need to get
a lady on the show, though.
Yes, that's true. I'm also recording a new series of Strangers on a Train. So.
No way!
Yeah.
Oh, shit, April. When are you doing that?
We start in early April. We're going up and down Wales.
Oh,
so we'll do three programs, and then we'll do another three, and then it'll be out on Radio 4 in June, I think.
It's very exciting. That's tickling. I'm very glad to hear that. I love that show. Good stuff. Right, have fun doing that then.
We're
both going on the road, aren't we?
Yeah, woohoo!
Hooray!
Rock and roll. See you all soon. Bye-bye.
Ciao, bello.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. You've been listening to the LSSL podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexiselpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.